This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Love now and
did you fall in love last time?
I love
love was stronger than anything.
For the love,
love. And I love you more than anything.
There's still love.
Love.
From the New York Times, I'm Anna Martin. This is Modern Love. Whenever I go to the bar, I like to do this thing where I attempt to figure out who's on their very first date. And it's really never that hard, because first dates have this incredibly specific energy. You can feel two people making calculations about one another in real time. This week's essay is about a first date that went super well, but there was no second date. And the author thinks he knows why. It's called Was It Me or My Teeth? Written and read by Damon Young.
I met her the way it felt like most people met in 2006, which means we met on MySpace. Its search function allowed you to filter for gender, female, age, 22 to 28, location, within 25 miles, and race, black. I was 27, newly single and aggressively broke. So browsing curated thumbnails in my bedroom was better than the club. I mean, she checked all my boxes. Fine, witty, active, single, age appropriate, and not too crunchy or churchy. And enough of a sense of humor to think that I'm funny, which is really all that mattered. And I guess most important, she has shared enough information on her profile that I could craft a DM to prove that I'd read it. Finally, someone else who thought Val Kilmer was the best Batman. She replied 20 minutes later. He was the best Elvis too. Proving she read my profile. I listed True Romance as one of my favorite movies. I waited 15 minutes to write back because, you know, I couldn't seem too thirsty. But she possessed no such need for performative coolness and wrote back immediately. Four hours and dozens of jokes and bets and flirts later, we agreed to meet at Barnes & Noble at 7 the next evening. In person, she was everything she was online, but 3% better. And the conversation was easy. We drank tea, we browsed books, we played footsie. It was the third best first date I'd ever been on. It was a Monday. We made soft plans to kick it that weekend. Maybe a movie, maybe food, maybe more. I called Wednesday to confirm. Voicemail. The next morning, she texted back. Hey, homie, it's been a crazy week. Rain check for the weekend, but let's try again soon. In movies sometimes, it takes a character a few more interactions like this to get the hint. A montage of unreturned texts and indisputably platonic voicemail messages as they make sad faces in car mirrors. This was not that. I mean, if the day later text was a sign, the hey homie was a flashing neon billboard. I mean, I was disappointed, sure, but I don't know. I was mostly just confused. I mean, I've been on enough first dates knowing things were going well enough to warrant a second, and this had felt like that. We remained friendly, and actually we still are. And then, a month or so after our date, she posted one of them like rapid response questionnaires to her profile. Fave food? Tacos. Fave artist? Aaliyah. And as I scrolled down, I found my answer. Deal maker? Great smile. deal breaker? Bad teeth. Bad teeth. So when I was 11 and I just moved my parents to East Lib, which is a neighborhood in Pittsburgh, this brazen, stubby white boy started calling me Beaver because of my slightly buck teeth and perpetual overbite. That nickname stuck. In fact, people who know me from then still know me as Beav. And then, like, by the time I reached high school and the rest of my face began to match my front teeth, a gap formed between them. And between the gap and the overbite, my teeth did the thing that happens when misaligned entities repeatedly crashed into each other. Some grinded, some eroded, some sharpened, and some separated from each other. Slowly but decisively, like my mouth was Pangea. I cannot recall a time when my teeth are not in need of drastic correction. I mean, specifically, I cannot recall a time when I felt like my teeth were not in need of drastic correction. A feeling that just lurked around and eventually consumed me because the world kept reminding me. Cartoons distinguish villains by giving them exaggerated or missing choppers. In movies, if you had noticeably bad teeth, you could be a goblin or a dope fiend. If lucky, you could be the not-hot dweeb who, by the third act, frisbees or braces off and becomes Halle Berry. But in real life, when I was roasted by friends or heckled by crowds during basketball away games, my teeth were usually the target. I remember how I felt when first clocking my date in the Barnes & Noble that night. Like, the pictures on my profile captured the range of possible looks I could have without revealing them. Smirking during a wedding toast, holding my infant cousin and squinting at her. A gallery curated to hide what I believed needed to be hidden. I was a toothfish. She'd have to see my teeth eventually, though. I mean, a relationship can't blossom if one of the people in it only opens their mouth when their partner blinks. So I decided to open mouth smile back. I don't know, there are infinite possible reasons she could have decided that night that I was cool enough to be cool with, but not attractive enough to be more with. First dates are when you're supposed to be discerning in particular, which is just a nice way of saying petty. And the gap between my front teeth is just one line in that poem. I don't know, I also know enough black women interested in black men to know that the symmetrical contrast of straight, bright whites against deep brown skin is a thing. And I know that in America, good, strong, bright, straight teeth signals good, strong, bright, straight money. The whiter the teeth, the whiter the credit. An open mouth is a resume, a Carfax, and a FICO score. And this, I know, is the real source of my neurosis. I mean, I'm 43. And for 35 or so of those years, I've either existed below the poverty line or a missed paycheck away from it. I've been broke adjacent. Broke. Poor. My mouth is a memoir of canceled orthodontist appointments when my parents couldn't afford the premium. Of never having two consecutive years of health care as an adult until I got Obamacare 2014. Of shame. That right there, that's the tricky one. The shame. Like, okay, I know now that there was nothing to be ashamed of, and that doing well while black in America is the exception, not the norm, and that exception could change with a coin flip. But then, all I wanted was a pantry. A pantry, to me, meant you had extra. Not too much. Not Jack and Jill money or anything like that, but I don't know, just enough to maybe not sweat too hard all the damn time. A pantry also meant good teeth. Because why wouldn't you have them if you can afford extra ketchups? This anxiety ain't new if you're black. I mean, we the world champs at faking it till you make it. I couldn't even really do that, though. Because as much as I try to stunt, my teeth always told the truth. I don't know, but maybe my teeth lied to me, too. Like, I think about all the times I've been asked why I don't smile more. It always felt like a taunt because I think, ain't it obvious? But maybe, I don't know, maybe it wasn't as obvious as I thought. Maybe that's just me getting game by shame. Maybe the black women who've been interested in me, the black women who've loved me, the black woman who married me, weren't compelled to overlook this conspicuous flaw because they liked the other parts. Like I was a nice new car with a cracked windshield. Maybe, to them, there was nothing to overlook. Maybe, to them, they were just my teeth. Maybe, to them, I have a nice smile. And maybe when I opened my mouth in that Barnes & Noble, she thought I had a nice smile too. I mean, I could just ask her. We're still cool. But I don't know. I just don't care as much anymore. Growth, right? Maturity? Perspective? Nah. I just have a pantry now. Invisalign, too.
After the break, another story about physical appearance. It's a story about hair, and it explores what hair signifies about identity and belonging and a mother's love.
This podcast is supported by Cartier.
Noelle was in London for a couple of weeks and we met on a dating app and we went on a first date on a Wednesday, and by the Thursday we were booking flights to Lisbon together. So it was a very successful first date. We just kept thinking this could be the last time we see each other. So we just made every moment so special. Every coffee, every meal we went on, every dance party we went to, it was like that was all that mattered. That was the moment, and we just felt everything, felt so much love for each other in that moment, and then the rest didn't matter. She's not ever been shy to make me feel loved, and she's never held back on making me feel special. And that to me is so important. From the day I met her, she made me feel like the most special person in the world. And now she's my wife.
With love, from Cartier.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
I'm Jackie Ostrowicki, and this is my tiny love story. Mothers and daughters often share a complicated relationship with hair. The desire for neatness can cause pain while expressing care. When I was young, I would protest when my Filipina mother curled my hair. It made her so frustrated that she would sometimes scream. Later, I would find her quietly crying behind my Barbie house. She never apologized, but her tears wiped the slate clean until the next tit for tat. It wasn't until I was older that I realized she, an immigrant in a challenging country, wanted me to look perfect, to protect me from the cruelty of the world.
Jackie, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah.
I gotta ask, what's the hairstyle that your mom was putting you in?
The hairstyle was, I don't know if it was uniquely 70s, but we have so many pictures of me with straight cut bangs all the way across my forehead. And then for the most part, we would be in these two high pigtails. For special occasions, she would curling iron ringlets kind of hanging down all around our hair with the same straight bangs.
Hmm. And can you tell me about the scene when she was getting you all ready?
So here I was, a five-year-old sitting on the toilet, and my mom had this giant heated stick in her hand, and she'd grab a strand of hair and wrap it around from top to bottom and then hold it there for like 10 to 15 seconds. And if you're five, you're terrified of that. Mm-hmm. You know, you can feel it right next to your head, kind of heating the hair up. And so she'd do that all the way around our head.
Wow. I want to know a little bit more about your mom. When did she immigrate to the United States?
So she immigrated in 1970 from the Philippines. She was a nurse, and she came over to Holy Cross Hospital in Chicago as an intern. And that's where she got her first job, kind of settled down in Chicago, met my dad, and then she had me in 1974. So it was like the swinging 70s when we were kids.
And how old was your mom when she came to the U.S.?
22. She was young.
And she came alone.
She was the first in her family, Anna, to come over. And then she ended up sponsoring all seven of her brothers and sisters. There were eight of them total. She sponsored all seven of them and her mother and father to come over.
Wow.
In the Filipino culture, the oldest sister, the oldest sibling has a really special place, and they even have a special name. So her name is Manong, which means oldest sister. That's her nickname or the name that they call her. And they have a large sense of responsibility. And so I think when she came over, maybe she wasn't like other 22-year-olds. I think she was thinking, I have a visa to come over and work. She got married, she got citizenship, and then she brought everyone else over. So because of that sense of responsibility, she's probably a little different than most 22-year-olds.
You wrote in the last line of your story that your mom was putting you in these perfect hairstyles to protect you. What was she protecting you from?
So if you think about someone who's a recent immigrant, I think you automatically stand out. Part of it probably just had to do with the fact that if the world is awry or if the world's a little out of your control, what do I have control of? Mm. I have control of myself. I have control of my appearance. I have control of my children. And that can help to set things right a little bit.
Right. There's a way to sort of, if everything is sort of spinning in ways you might not understand, you think about the things that you can hold on to or control, like you're saying. And one of them is how you look or how your kids look. And as you got older, did your mom continue to fixate on your appearance in the way she did when you were younger?
Absolutely. Even as an adult, you know, she'll say things, we'll Zoom and she'll say things like, oh, hon, I think your lipstick is too red. You should wear another shade. Or she'll comment on an aspect of clothing or hair. And so she's still very aware of it. And she's still very particular herself. She's still very put together in how she presents. She doesn't leave the house without makeup. She would never leave the house in a sweatshirt and sweatpants.
When she says those things to you about your lipstick, how does it feel with those sort of like motherly nitpicking comments?
It's kind of hard to get over it, not to feel judged. Mm-hmm. But as I've gotten older, I realized she's coming from a place of love when she says those things. For her, love meant protection. Love meant control. Love meant doing things a certain way. And when she does those things now, it doesn't mean that she is trying to control us. It means that she loves us.
Do you hear your mom's voice when you're getting ready in the morning these days?
I try not to. I try to hear my own voice. A lot of times I'm so focused on getting my own kiddo ready. I've got a daughter who's 11, and I'm trying not to repeat these cycles with her. You know, we've had a lot of back and forth about hair, the two of us. And here's what's interesting. I inadvertently created the exact same hairstyle on my daughter that I had growing up. bangs and pigtails. And we would have these conflicts about hair. You know, I was combing it too hard. She was afraid I was going to poke her eye when I was cutting her bangs. And I sat here and I thought, why am I repeating this? Why am I having the same arguments with my daughter that I had with my mom?
Hmm. What was your answer to that question to yourself? Why am I continuing these patterns?
So I thought about it and I realized I was just picking up what she had always done, right? She had done it that way. And so I was doing it that way. Hmm. And I knew she was doing it because she loved me. And I was doing it because I loved my daughter, but my daughter didn't feel loved, right? And you have to understand that we had a different experience. Like, my daughter has blonde hair and blue eyes, and so she's not living the immigrant experience. She's not living with an immigrant mother. And so when I did those things to her, she didn't understand. Hmm. And as I thought through it, I realized I've got to let go. I've got to let her be who she is.
Right.
And the other thing I realized is love doesn't have to be being perfect. My form of love could be letting go.
Hmm. Jackie, I learned so much from this conversation. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Anna, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
On the next Modern Love, a woman knows exactly the type of guy she wants to end up with. And then she meets someone totally different. That's next week. Modern Love is produced by Julia Botero and Hans Buto. It's edited by Sarah Saracen. This episode was mixed by Dan Powell, who also created our Modern Love theme music. Original music in this episode by Dan Powell and Marian Lozano. Digital production by Mahima Chablani. The Modern Love column is edited by Daniel Jones. Mia Lee is the editor of Modern Love Projects. I'm Anna Martin. Thanks for listening.